I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. These have been tumultuous times at National Public Radio. It started with the firing of analyst Juan Williams last year, the departure of NPR News executive Ellen Weiss because of her handling of the Juan Williams situation, and more recently, the misreporting of the death of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, and efforts to defund public broadcasting in Congress have put a bright light on NPR. We'll talk with National Public Radio President Vivian Schiller about those issues. Plus, University of Central Florida English professor Anna Lilios discusses the legacy of Zora Neale Hurston. Those conversations ahead on Intersection. Vivian Schiller is the president and CEO of National Public Radio. She took that post in 2009, and prior to that, Schiller managed NewYorkTimes.com. She was also a senior vice president and general manager of the Discovery Times Channel. Vivian Schiller, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
It's very good to have you with us. We'll get to all the issues affecting NPR in a moment, but I want to take advantage of having you here in the studio with us and use this as a chance for our listeners to learn a little bit more about you. You've worked at so many different media operations. What made you want to come to NPR?
Oh, well, it was a pretty easy choice, I got to tell you. I've been very lucky in my career and worked for some pretty big media companies and really enjoyed my experiences and learned a lot, including the Turner Broadcasting Organization, CNN, Discovery, and the New York Times. But when the opportunity came along 2 years ago to lead NPR, which I have been said so much respect for and been such a loyal listener to for so many years, I just jumped at the opportunity.
What stands out as the difference between NPR and those other media groups that you just mentioned?
Well, I respect and admire all of those companies, so it's been great experiences and they all do great work. But what I saw is the opportunity at NPR is to build on a news organization and a radio network that had nothing but potential, already very successful, but because of the unique structure of public radio, the national and local partnership, and because of the business model of public radio, to me, it seemed like an opportunity for growth, whereas so many other media organizations, unfortunately, in this economy and this media system where there's so many different sources, many places are shrinking.
News analyst Juan Williams. He was let go in October over remarks he made regarding Muslim dress while on Fox News. Basically, he said, when he gets on a plane, sees people wearing traditional Muslim clothes, he gets nervous. There's been a lot of confusion about what happened next after those comments. And I wonder, what can you tell us about the sequence of events that led to Juan Williams being let go?
Yes, indeed, there has been a lot of confusion, sadly. And part of the reason is mistakes that we at NPR made in the way that we handled it. But here are the facts. Juan Williams was a part-time news analyst for NPR. And remarks that he makes on other media, that was one, but there were a series of other incidents over time, made us increasingly uncomfortable in the sense that his remarks were inconsistent with his role as a news analyst. It wasn't about the nature of remarks or what he said. It was about the fact that he is a news analyst and what our expectations are for an NPR news analyst to provide only news analysis and not offer personal opinion on other media. And so we did terminate his contract, and as I said earlier, we didn't handle it very well. I've admitted that publicly almost since the day it happened. And it's really unfortunate. I've apologized to our listeners and to Juan himself for the way that we conducted it. We could have done better, and we will do better.
Let me ask you about that, because you mentioned that the content, the substance of his remarks were not the particular reason for him being let go. But what can you tell us about the immediacy with which he was released from his NPR contract? This, for our listeners who might not be aware, a phone call was made by Ellen Weiss, the head of NPR News, and that's how he was terminated.
Well, that's right. Look, like I said, we made mistakes. He certainly, his contract should not have been terminated over the phone. There's no question about that. We didn't handle it well. It was a poorly handled personnel decision. And unfortunately, because we handled it poorly, And there was a lot of media involved. It really became a national story. And a lot of people, unfortunately, jumped to conclusions about why we made the decision that they did. And that's been frustrating to a lot of people. And I understand that. And I regret that frustration that people feel about it.
I think a lot of listeners wonder, just seeing what he said and then the reaction that followed, wonder why not, for example, some sort of probation or something like that.
You know, looking into with pure clarity into the crystal ball of hindsight, there are all manner of ways that we could have handled it. But all we can do now is acknowledge that we made some mistakes in the process, learn from it, and do better.
NPR has always prided itself on holding its reporters to very high standards of objectivity. The network has a very detailed ethics code. In fact, here at MFE, we drew on that ethics code as a resource when we wrote our own journalistic ethics policy. Did Juan Williams sign the National Public Radio Journalistic Ethics Code?
We don't actually have our reporters and news analysts sign, but we do expect them to conduct themselves according to the terms of the ethics code. But I'm glad you brought up the ethics code because, in fact, we're doing a thorough review of that ethics code, which was created in 2004, partly just to, you know, in light of recent events, just to make sure that there is consistency and that there's clarity. And partly because, frankly, it's time. The media world has changed a lot since 2004, and so it really was high time for us to do a review. We've got a task force put together of journalists and citizens and getting input. In fact, we're getting input from some listeners to WMFE right here in Orlando this week, and we will be reevaluating that review and republishing it.
Williams was a news analyst and not a reporter, and so this incident, of course, has prompted conversations around our newsroom and many other media organizations about the difference between what a reporter is, what an analyst is, and what a commentator does.
Sure
what
has.
Do you think about those distinctions, Vivian, and do you think that did you think through those issues when you were considering what to do with Juan Williams?
You know, a lot of people are confused about the difference between a straight journalist, a news analyst, and a commentator. And the reason they're confused is because it's really confusing. And in fact, the changes in media today have blurred those lines.
And when you say that, you're referring to technology?
No, well, partly to technology, but partly because of the nature of new news organizations and changes to news institutions, whether it's cable news, whether it is blogging, whether it's news delivered by Twitter and Facebook. And a lot of those lines that used to be quite clear in the more traditional journalism world are blurred. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, that this is a bad thing. It's just the reality as journalism, which is a vibrant, active, ever-changing institution, profession, the definitions begin to change. And so part of the reason we're doing this review of our news ethics code is to, and we're discussing this very actively with our task force right now, which is to clarify, well, what does that mean exactly? And do those, are there distinctions? And what is the role of, should there be a role for a news analyst or a commentator on NPR or not? And if they are, what should they? So we're taking this opportunity to take a fresh look at all of that. And when we're done with input, again, from listeners, from journalists, from people inside NPR, outside NPR, we will communicate that to our public, seek input, and make sure that whatever we do, it is clear and it is consistent so that we don't have any more kind of confusion again.
A lot of the public discourse about what happened with Juan Williams centered on the First Amendment, the idea that NPR was trying to curtail Juan Williams' right to free speech came up when he was making those comments on Fox News. And this also brings up another topic about what journalistic objectivity is. And I wonder, where do you come down on this question? Where does the line come down for a private citizen and a professional journalist? When does one stop and where does one start on those roles?
Look, I am as big a supporter of the First Amendment as anybody in this nation. And in fact, I'm not only that, but I am incredibly supportive as a journalist and as a news executive in making sure that At NPR, we present a diversity of views, a diversity of opinions, and you can't listen to Morning Edition and All Things Considered for more than a few minutes without hearing widely varied points of view on all sorts of things. So we embrace debate. We embrace ranging views. We think it's important for our audience to hear a variety of viewpoints so that they can become more informed and make their own decisions. When it comes to Juan Williams, the issue there was his remarks that he was making on other media were inconsistent with his role as an NPR news analyst. And that was all that it was about. It was not a curtailment of his First Amendment. It was purely an inconsistency between the role that we expect our news analysts to play and public comments that they might make elsewhere.
What is that role? What role are they expected to play?
Well, news analysts are there to provide insight into the news based on fact, and really our expectation for our journalists is that they're not whether on NPR or whether on other news media that they are not coming down on any particular side of an issue. That's just not the role that we expect them to play. Certainly, any citizens in this country is free to express their point of view, but when you're a news analyst on NPR, there's a certain role we expect you to play.
Are you saying there's restrictions as a news professional then?
Well, I wouldn't call it restrictions. I would call it just the professional responsibilities of journalists to not weigh in on controversial subjects.
What about in terms of new media, something like a Facebook page? Many people today have their own personal Facebook page. Is it okay to express your opinion on a particular issue on that if you are an NPR journalist?
If you're an NPR journalist, our expectations is that you conduct yourself in the same way that we would expect an NPR journalist to conduct themselves in any public platform.
So there are rules.
Well, yeah, there absolutely. There are principles in our code of ethics. So, for example, if you're an NPR journalist and you, talk about the spaghetti carbonara that you had last night and it was really delicious or it was really terrible, that's okay. But do we expect you to weigh in with your opinion about the healthcare debate? Absolutely not.
We're talking with Vivian Schiller. She's the CEO and president of NPR. And if you want to comment on what we've been talking about here on this interview, you can always head over to the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. You're listening to 90.7 WMFE FM Orlando. This is Intersection, and I'm Mark Simpson. There were moves on Capitol Hill last week by congressional Republicans to eliminate funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, receives about $445 million a year from the federal government. How worried are you about this?
Well, we take it very seriously, these calls to defund public broadcasting. It would be really devastating to public broadcasting if those federal dollars would be lost, both to public television and to public radio and to stations like WMFE.
How likely do you think it is that Congress would actually make that move? These threats have come up before previously in the 1990s. It seems to cycle around periodically.
Right.
How likely do you think it is that it would actually happen?
Well, look, I'm in the reporting business and not the speculation business, so I don't really want to speculate. All I can tell you is that we take this very, very seriously. And so
is this round more serious of a threat than in the 1990s? I know you weren't with NPR at that time, but from what you've been able to gather?
You know, I think it feels very sort of scary and threatening each time it happens. You're right, I wasn't here. But I will tell you that this feels very real to us and we're taking it very seriously and working with our 40 million listeners to public radio. And frankly, there are 170 million people who touch public broadcasting in some form every month, and saying, you know what, if you care about this content, then speak up.
In the aftermath of what happened with Juan Williams, him being let go in the manner he was, there was an internal NPR investigation. It was found that NPR did nothing legally wrong. You were sanctioned yourself, and Ellen Weiss, the head of the NPR news unit, resigned. Do you think that those responses have been appropriate to the incident itself?
Well, what you're referring to is the board engaged the Weil firm, which is a law firm that has experience and does these kind of governance reviews all the time. And so the board engaged them, and as a result of what they learned from this review, they made a series of, first of all, they announced a series of findings, including the fact that Juan Williams' contract was terminated in accordance with the terms of his contract and that there was no undue influence from any kind of donor or interest group in this. And they made a series of recommendations about what NPR should do going forward, including the ethics review, which was already underway, and tightening up a lot of our processes and procedures. So we have now closed the book on that review, and I think that I was very gratified by the findings, and I think that the board's comments were completely appropriate about needing to go forward with the review of our code of ethics and tightening up our processes. That's absolutely appropriate.
This month, on January 8th, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot in the head while at an event in Tucson, Arizona. NPR was the first national news outlet to report on the shooting and reported first that Giffords had been killed. NPR corrected this story, but other news organizations had started to report that the Congresswoman was dead in a chain reaction that was kicked off by that NPR report. What can you tell us about what happened and why it happened?
Yeah, this was a really devastating reporting error on the part of on the part of NPR. There's really no two ways about it. We were the first to erroneously, of course, report that that she died. Other news organizations then matched that reporting. So I heard her husband interviewed on Diane Sawyer the other day, saying they first learned about it from television. So, boy, we all really share in the blame for this. And what we've done at NPR, of course, is corrected the mistake as soon as we realized that it was wrong, posted an editor's note on our website, apologized for the error repeatedly on the air. We've been in contact with the family, and we cooperated, of course, with a column, two columns, actually, from our ombudsman, talking about how the mistake was made, and lastly, have communicated with the news staff about what happened and the process failures to make sure that they didn't happen again. We take this very seriously, and we have taken every corrective action we can to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Can you tell us about some of the standards that are in place to prevent that from happening again?
Oh, sure. Well, listen, you know, there's the kind of bar that you need to reach to report that somebody has died, of course, should be, among other news events, just about should be the highest bar. And it really requires very, very careful sourcing, careful vetting of the sourcing, and the participation of senior executives and the news staff. And,
did that not happen?
Well, there were some mistakes. There were some mistakes that were made. It's laid out in the ombudsman column, and it's what can I say? It was a terrible mistake, and we've apologized for it. And I understand why people are upset about it. They should be. We take the responsibility to accurately report the news extremely seriously. So this is really, really unfortunate.
Vivian, would you say it happened because standards that were already in place were not followed, or because the standards that were in place were not correct enough to reach that threshold for accuracy?
Oh, no. The standards in place were fine. It's just that there was some procedural issues that weren't followed. No, that was not the issue at all. But, of course, we have taken the opportunity to remind the news staff again specifically what those standards are. It's really unfortunate that we had to do it in the wake of such a mistake like this.
NPR has traditionally been known for following a very staid course when reporting on breaking news events, sometimes maybe even to the point of sacrificing immediacy for making sure that accuracy is maintained. And I wonder, do you think because of the changing news environment, the 24-hour news cycle, and the push by NPR to be a more aggressive news organization in terms of live reporting contributed at all to this situation?
Look, I'm glad you brought that up, because we are among the most careful news organizations in this country. That's why it is extremely unusual for us to make mistakes like this. Of course, we are competitive as journalists, but as the adage goes, better to get it right than get it first. So there's no question that this is, again, unusual for NPR and very serious. However, it was really just a mistake in sourcing. The reporters that were there at the time thought they had this information completely verified, and they did not. It was not. I would caution you, or from any of the listeners to the show, to think this is some kind of trend where we have to be the first at breaking news. That is not the most important thing.
We're talking with Vivian Schiller. She's the CEO and president of National Public Radio. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Mark Simpson. Vivian, where is NPR headed next? What is on the horizon for National Public Radio? I know you've focused a lot on the online product, the NPR.org website. Is that going to be an area of focus for the future, or is radio the way to go in the coming years?
Yes and yes.
Yes and yes.
So we're going to grow our radio journalism, absolutely. We are in constant innovation mode, even in radio. In terms of our programming, we're looking at new beats. We've established new bureaus overseas. We've launched an investigative unit. We're actually expanding coverage in certain areas like books. And so we are in growth mode. I feel that our responsibility, as so many news organizations are stepping away from coverage of everything from foreign to science to the arts, that it is our role to step in and fill that void. So we will continue to provide that content, whether it's on the radio, on the iPad, on your mobile phone, via Twitter, whatever platform, however anybody wants to consume us, we're going to be there.
What do you listen to when you're not listening to National Public Radio?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anything else to listen
Come
to?
Come on now. Be honest.
I listen to music. Well, here's the thing is I've got teenagers, and now that they're in the front seat, there is the epic battle for control over the radio dial. So I sometimes win that, and sometimes I lose that, and we listen to all kinds of music, pop channels in the Washington area. So so I hear a lot of that.
Do your kids complain if you put on National Public Radio?
One does and one doesn't, and I'm not going to rat them out to tell you which one.
Don't rat them out, but listen, we know that happens. We know NPR can get slugged as mom.
Yeah.
You're listening
exactly.
to that again. Vivian Schiller is the president and CEO of National Public Radio. Vivian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark. It's been great to be here.
Coming up, the legacy of writer Zora Neale Hurston. This is Intersection. The annual festival honoring African-American writer Zora Neale Hurston is underway in Eatonville this week. Hurston is famous for her 1937 novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, and her views on race and women. Here to talk about why Zora Neale Hurston is still important today is University of Central Florida English professor Anda Lilios. Her book about the friendship between Zora Neale Hurston and Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, Crossing the Creek, came out last year. Anna, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
It's good to have you with us. So Zora Neale Hurston passed away in 1960. Why are people in the literary world still celebrating her writing?
Well, I think besides the fact that she was an outstanding writer and really at the forefront now of the American literature canon, she was also at the forefront of her ideas about race and culture. And I think, there was a lot of prejudice at the time in which she lived. But now I think America is moving more towards her multicultural ideal.
Why did she have that kind of multicultural vision at a time in the 1930s all the way through the 60s when it wasn't such a prominent view?
Well, perhaps it was because she was raised in Eatonville. She wasn't born there. She was born in the Deep South in Notasalga, Alabama. But her father moved the family there when she was very young. And it was, of course, the first all-black incorporated town in America. And it really engendered a sense of self-pride, community pride, and self-empowerment.
What do you think makes her style different from other writers of the same period?
Well, I think it is that connection to Eatonville, her ability to really go in to the communities and live with the people. She talks about when she first went to the lumber camps in Polk County, that she had her Arab Barnard around her. And she just realized that she couldn't go in there with that kind of an attitude. And she quickly adjusted and became very close to the people, and I think that really helped her.
We're talking with Anna Lilios. She's professor of English at the University of Central Florida and has written about the relationship of Zora Neale Hurston and Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings. And I wonder, Anna, tell us, what was that relationship like between these two Florida writers?
Well, I concentrated on the year 1942 when they were both at the height of their fame. They'd just published their memoirs, so to speak, Cross Creek by Rawlings and Their Eyes, Dust Tracks on a Road by Hurston. Hurston was on the cover of Life magazine and Saturday Review, and Rawlings was one of the star writers of Scribner's and hobnobbed with Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And they met probably in St. Augustine, probably Mary Spreesard Holland, the wife of the governor, introduced them. And they immediately struck up a friendship. And it was a great challenge for Rawlings because she was very prejudiced. And this is, you know, obvious to anyone who reads Cross Creek. But I believe that her views on race evolved as she got to know Hurston, and she actually became an advocate for civil rights.
Those views of Rawlings on race came to be something of a controversy in terms of her friendship with Zora Neale Hurston, because Zora Neale Hurston went to stay at Cross Creek, and there's been some controversy as to whether or not Hurston was made to stay at the servants' quarters at Cross Creek because of her race. You've researched this. What'd you find?
Well, that's a really interesting point, and that's sort of Florida legend, you know, that here Rawlings spent the day talking to Hurston as an equal, and then at night she sent her to the servants' quarters, the tenant house, at the farm up in Cross Creek. That view was put forth by Rawlings' educated servant, Idella Parker, who wrote about it in her book. But I haven't been able to corroborate that. And about a year after they met, in 1943, Rawlings actually invited Hurston to stay in the main house with her. And she wrote extremely long letters to her husband, and that's why we know that she did stay in the house. But she never wrote anything about sending Hurston to the tenant farmhouse. So I'm not sure that that really happened.
Well, Zora Neale Hurston's career declined in later years. Why has she again risen to prominence among literary circles today?
Well, Alice Walker, quote-unquote, rediscovered her in the 70s, and you know, just said it's terrible that we have neglected our, you know, our great writers. And Walker came back to Florida and tried to find Hurston's grave in Fort Pierce and identified, you know, where it is. And people just began passing out Hurston's works in classes, and you know, she just really took on like wildfire, I guess you'd say.
Is it something that's only in Florida, or is this national and international?
Oh, no, she's a national writer, definitely.
The Zora Neale Hurston Festival is underway in Eatonville. I know you've been in years past and contributed to it. What's it like?
It is amazing. I've gone to every single festival since they began, and I've just heard the most amazing speakers, from Henry Louis Gates to bell hooks. All the great African-American intellectuals have been invited there, including Alice Walker has also appeared there. It's really, really a great experience. I'd like to urge everyone to go.
Anna Lilios is professor of English at the University of Central Florida. Her book, Crossing the Creek, The Literary Friendship of Zora Neale Hurston and Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, came out last year. Anna, thanks for stopping by.
You're very welcome.
You can find a link to this year's Zora Festival at our website, wmfe.org/intersection. There you'll also be able to find web extras with NPR President Vivian Schiller, plus links to our weekly podcast and the Florida Talks blog. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.